views, information, or opinions expressed in this broadcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not represent those of any other persons or entities. Furthermore, some of the activities discussed might be dangerous or illegal. Attempt them at your own risk. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Peculiar World here on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Tonight's podcast is a little bit different. It's going to be a little bit of biographical on myself and some of my work. As I hope many of you know, I've written or contributed to over a dozen books on history, military history, as well as the paranormal. And two of my more famous books, at least within the Pacific Northwest, are Weird Washington and Weird Oregon, which I wrote under contract to a company called Sterling Publishing. And they were a subsidiary of Barnes & Noble, and that's where the books were first put out on the shelves. Now, every single state in the Union was supposed to get their own book. Weird Washington, Weird Oregon, Weird Massachusetts, and so on. Each of these books had a formula for success, and it really was a tour de force of the peculiar world, state by state. So I'm going to have a discussion about what went on behind the scenes, how these books were formatted and put together, and I hope this interests you all, and I have help. I am talking to my friend, artist, and author, Al Euphrasio, who co-authored the books Weird Washington and Weird Oregon with me. How are you doing, Al?
Hey, I'm good, Jeff. Good to be here.
Good to be alive.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Now, Al and I have known each other, gosh, 2007 did we meet?
Yeah, about...
Eight
to 10 years ago, yeah, something like that.
We're actually looking at closer to 10 to 12 because the older we get a little while ago is actually quite a while ago.
It also depends on when you release the podcasts.
That's true, too. Now, when Al and I, we actually didn't meet... live, we actually met by the internet first, and I was actually an unknown quantity to Mark Moran and Mark Skirman, the two men who created the Weird US series. But what about you, Al?
I was somewhat of an unknown quantity to them, I believe, just because I'd only written, I guess this leads into the whole thing of how I knew them and how I got onto the project. Years before I discovered their magazine, Weird New Jersey, you know, the subject matter really grabbed me. And as an artist slash illustrator, I contacted them and said, hey, you know, is there any kind of work I can do for you guys? And I started getting assignments to draw little things for the magazine. And then that kind of extended it into the book series once those started. But overall, I'd only written a couple of articles for them, for the magazine. So I think I was an unknown quantity in as far as be dependable in writing something a little more long form.
Yeah, you, what art schools? You went, you're actually school trained. You're not just some guy with talent. You're actually...
Right. I went to the Cooper School of Art in Dover, New Jersey, and they taught mainly comic book art because the founder of the school was a comic book artist and editor for years for DC Comics. But they kind of ran the whole gamut from, you know, commercial art in general.
Yeah, but you're from New Jersey as well, right? And so that really was the impetus for the books. If you wanted to talk a little bit about Weird NJ.
They started off as a magazine called Weird New Jersey. And they'd been around since, I want to say the mid to late 90s at this point. And it came out twice a year. There's, I believe, about 50 issues available. And at some point in the early 2000s, they started selling them on consignment at Barnes & Noble. And the story goes that people at Barnes & Noble discovered that they were selling more than, say, Time magazine. And they said, hey, you know, these guys are onto something. They have this, not genre, but, you know, they had this gimmick that seems to be working really well. We should have them adapted into a book. And so Weird New Jersey, the magazine, was adapted into, you know, Weird New Jersey, the book, which was more or less a compilation of things that had been in the magazine already, maybe rewritten or updated. And then from there, they decided to expand it to other states. And, you know, where Mark Moran and Mark Sperman, the editors, couldn't cover things themselves, they started subcontracting to local authors around the country to write about their states.
Which is...
And I guess your story was that you had contributed some ghost stories to them or let them use some of your own stories?
Yeah, what ended up happening in my case, and just like getting this podcast set up on the Paranormal UK network, it's kind of a trial by doing. I got an email from Mark Moran saying, "Hey, Jeff Davis, visited your website, liked your stuff. How would you like to do something for our next book," which was a book called Weird Hauntings? They said, "Can you rework some of your other stories and send them in, and we'll pay you," I think they paid me $50 a story, and I sent them three stories. And within a month of that, I got another email from Mark saying, "Hey, Jeff, believe it or not, this was kind of your little test marketing. How do you like to be the principal author of Weird Washington? Oh, and you're not going to be the sole author. We have this guy named Al who we owe a favor or two to."
Yeah, I guess my first, you know, their first mention of Weird Washington to me was I'd finished up some illustrations for one of the other books. I don't remember which one. And, you know, I'd written them an email. I'm like, "Well, you know, this is fun. Looking forward to more work. Keep me in mind when you do Weird Washington." And the very next email I got was, "Well, funny you should mention that, because we have this guy, Jeff, and we wanted to ask you if you'd be willing to write a book with him." And that kind of blew me away. That was, you know, pretty intimidating at the time.
Yeah, I could tell. We exchanged emails. I don't think we even called and talked on the phone at first. We just exchanged emails, and my wife, Janine, and I were on our way up to the Sound, Puget Sound, and we met up.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and you and I were purposely not looking at each other, I think.
I don't recall that, but okay.
Yeah. And for people who've not written a book, this was the first book I wrote on consignment to somebody else other than my own books. And the process was pretty interesting and pretty nifty. I've talked to other authors who've written multiple books for different publishers, and you and I actually kind of got a great deal from the Marks. I think, if I recall, we had to start
off... Which is why we're not rich off of royalties.
Well, I tell that behind the scene story about Weird Oregon, because you remember Weird Washington was a runaway success. What was it? The first print run of 20,000 sold out within like 90 days.
Oh, yeah.
And it was on the Barnes & Noble bestseller list. It was bestselling in Washington for like 2 or 3 months as well.
It was on the state library's list of recommended books for middle school to high school aged kids.
Yep. Introduction to Washington State History.
Just because, yeah, we covered a lot of history.
Yeah. And it was good. It was a work for hire contract, which means you and I did the work. We wrote the articles, and they paid us as soon as we sent them the articles. And it was kind of generous too, in that they said, "We want photographs and you guys take the pictures and send them to us." For Weird Oregon, I got an email from Mark Moran saying, "Hey, Weird Washington was such a good book sales wise. Would you guys like a piece of the royalties? Only we're going to cut your fee per chapter in half. Is that okay with you guys?" That's how I remember it.
Oh yeah. I mean, to this day I get royalty checks, so it wasn't that bad a deal.
Yeah, it wasn't, as far as I'm concerned. This is one of these kind of adult decisions that we make. It's not a guarantee. And I know the Marks thought that they were sharing a great deal with us. They cut the chapter fee in half, essentially, which was about, I think it was about $1,250 less per chapter. The bad thing was the book didn't sell very well, and it was about 3 years before we got royalty checks.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and if
it was definitely a gamble.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I count, then I wrote six chapters of Weird Oregon, you wrote six chapters. Counting that out, we took a cut of about $9,000 each. And I haven't gotten $9,000 in royalties. I don't know about you.
Oh, no, by no means did we. I'm not getting any more than you are, so.
Yeah, but yeah. You know, that's the breaks in the publishing realm. Uh-huh. And it was a generous offer. Too bad we didn't get that offer for Weird Washington.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, you split the difference of the profits between the two and you kind of count it all together, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, and it was a great opportunity. People paid us to go to places that we would have gone to anyway, which is another bonus. And for those people listening on this podcast, believe it or not, this is one of the things that authors, when they get together, they talk a lot about is the financial end and the logistical end of publishing. It's not all about the ghosts and other strange things.
I mean, I've spoken with other authors of, you know, just paranormal or weird kind of esoteric topics. All of them have some story of, frankly, getting a worse treatment than we ever could say we did.
Absolutely. And yeah. So all kudos go to the Marks, who are kind of heroic in their own way, because they had a TV show one season of The Weird U.S.
Yeah, they did. I thought they were doing something else now as well.
Oh, probably. But the interesting thing is that they said, if I get this right, when they got offered a second or more season, they said, this is taking away from our book publishing end, and we're happier just with earning less money with the weird New Jersey books and business.
Yeah, I mean, it sounded like it was taking them away from their families for extended amounts of time just because they had to travel around the country so much, and it kind of began distracting from their what they consider their primary jobs.
Yeah,
and business, whatever.
And kudos to them for having that courage. Now, the whole process you and I went through to put these books together was something new to me. We started off, if I recall, with a spreadsheet.
Yes, that's right.
And
we had what were the columns on that again? It was the topic, of course. Topic, location.
Yeah, there are 12 chapters in the books, and
yes,
I didn't memorize all of them, but there's one on cemeteries, local legends, of course UFOs and kind of Bigfoot critters, and one on ghosts and major legends and major personalities,
heroes and villains.
Yeah, and so in order you and I didn't get to pick which stories to write about. They had a whole vetting process.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was kind of like everybody contributed, and then the editors had the final say.
Yeah.
I think what was included.
Each chapter had 10 stories in it. We had to submit 20 story ideas, and then we kind of massage back and forth picking the 10.
That's right. So we had, like, the stories, the chapters, the locations, because we also wanted to make sure we had a good coverage of the state. Because a lot of my stuff ended up being in the Seattle area just because I live around here and it's kind of just population-wise more concentrated, so there's more opportunities for weirdness, essentially.
Yeah, and you had...
And it's Seattle.
And you had the whole fun thing with all the local personalities, too. Was it the one dancing guy?
It was a guy that used to stand around in Bellevue in front of a particular building dancing. He was, you know, he was a sign guy, but he didn't always have a sign. He would just go out there for his own pleasure and dance around on the sidewalk. And I think that's how he started. And eventually people started handing him signs.
Interesting.
Hey, call attention to our business.
Well, good for him. He was a pioneer then.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, that is one of those jobs that right now, as I'm getting on in years, if I were living in Seattle or Portland, where the minimum wage is, what is it now, $15 or $16 an hour?
Yeah, it's edging up to 15 by law, I guess.
You know, spinning a sign for $15 an hour is not necessarily a bad thing. It'd keep me in shape.
It's a gig.
Yeah, and I guarantee at the end of the day when I put my sign away and go home, take off my coat, put the sign down, I'd be able to let go of that job and the stress wouldn't follow me.
You know, as an aside, I'm reminded of a story. I have a buddy. I haven't spoken to him in years, but I had a buddy who was a Seattle cop, and he told me a story where he got tangled up in some minor office politics or something, and his kind of ticked off his sergeant. So his sergeant assigned him to weeks just kind of sitting guard under some underpass by some bridge in Seattle somewhere, and he was just supposed to. You know, supposedly that was a high crime area and he was just supposed to stay there and keep the peace. But, you know, really it was it was a punishment. You know, let's have this guy sit here 8 to 10 hours a day and do nothing. So he said, yeah, you know, I kind of had a nice little vacation of sorts. I'd bring paperback books with me and read all day. And when my 2 weeks was up and my sarge, you know, and the sergeant tried to reassign me, I told him no. I said, he said that he told the sergeant that union rules specify that any changes in assignment or location have to be, or an officer has to be informed a week ahead of time. And so as per that rule, he was going to opt to stay there another week, which pissed off his sergeant even further.
Yeah, but then the punishment wouldn't fit, would it?
Yeah, I suppose not.
Well, and that kind of leads me and reminds me, you write the book, and that's not all that has to do with it. You write the book, then you have to promote the book. And you and I did some signings together. And I want to apologize now in front of this audience. I remember one time, I think the signing was up in Linwood or something, and you said, oh, hey, Jeff, you know, it's going to be you, me, but also the goddess Kringa. She wants to sit in on this one, too.
Right. Spoken to her, and I don't know, somehow or another the talk of that possibility came up, and I was non-committal, but she thought I'd said yeah, okay, yeah, you can, you know, sit in with us sometime as kind of an added attraction.
Yeah. And for those people who don't know who the goddess Kringa was, maybe you could mention that.
Oh, she was a public access TV personality in the 90s and early 2000s. I'm not entirely sure. She did some web stuff afterwards. I'm not entirely sure if she's still performing, but she did a lot of things with nudity and body paint and just stream of consciousness poetry.
Sort of like updated Beatnik Bongos kind of thing, only.
Yeah, know. Kind of.
Yeah, and I saw some stuff. You sent me some links, and she's kind of interesting gal.
She, oh God, what can be said about her? I mean, she participated in the Fremont Solstice Parade and things like that, where, you know, typically you have nude bike riders and things like that.
Yeah.
But she kind of became a local personality just from having this extremely weird public access TV show.
Yeah, and when you came back to her and said, Jeff said no, what was her reaction?
She was upset.
Yeah,
I don't think she was totally despondent, but she was like, "What the hell, man? I thought we had a plan." I was like, "No, you thought we did. I didn't actually promise this as much as you thought I did. You know, we worked it out."
Yeah, yeah, and I explained in greater detail later about people who have what I call the Jerry Springer moment. People will go on Jerry Springer so that they're famous for their 30 seconds. And I had book signings and events because I'd been writing books on the paranormal for years. And there have been a couple times when I've invited people up on stage with me or at the event, and they kind of took it over. And it got scary a couple times. But we almost had something like that happen. You and I were at one of these book signings, and one of your witnesses came to it. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. I just remember him talking to us about it for like an extended amount of time.
Yeah. And that's,
I was going to say, I didn't know if you took it any differently than that.
Well, I didn't mind that necessarily. But when he started talking about UFOs and and how he was abducted, and then
yeah, I don't remember that.
you may have. I don't know, but
might have zoned out at that point.
Yeah. Well, the Barnes & Noble store manager, you know, our the acting manager for the day was there. And so he came in and was kind of chatting and seeing how the event was going. And I did. I saw his eyes. They didn't glaze over. His eyes got much wider. And he actually did start backing away a little bit. He was really uncomfortable. But that's the reason why I was always wanting to kind of vet who our guests were.
I had I think it was a solo book signing at a Costco somewhere. God, I don't remember where. I want to say it was towards the Tri-Cities somewhere. But in any case, I had this signing where older gentleman, kind of dressed like an old-fashioned sea captain, came up and started talking to me quite extensively, and I actually found him interesting. And so we chatted up, and he's, you know, talking all this business like he was a retired angel investor. And, you know, I started talking about my other life as a video game developer, and video games for mobile phones were just then starting to pick up momentum. You know, he started talking in terms of, well, hey, you know, if you ever decide you want to embark on a project, come talk to me. And I have this friend who I work with, and, you know, we've funded a couple of things, and call me when you're done doing whatever here, we'll talk. And so I did. And I met with his friend, met mainly with his friend after this. You know, we had these grandiose plans for, you know, starting up a little educational game development studio. And then within a few weeks, I started getting these weird phone calls at 3 a.m. and they were all slurred and I couldn't quite tell what was going on. I thought there was a glitch with my phone or something. Turns out that the guy, not the sea captain guy, but his buddy, it turns out he was like an alcoholic, and he was just cold calling me in the middle of the night. And he was like really despondent one time. And he's like, oh, well, you know, I'm an alcoholic and I just have these issues. And I pretty much severed ties at that point. I mean, you know, all the best of luck to him, but I was kind of unprepared to deal with that. And I just met the guy. I kind of felt like it was a little odd, as it were, to dump those kinds of problems on me right away.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, again, the part that with whatever kind of fame you and I have gotten from these books, there are odd prices to pay at odd times. I won't mention the exact article, but there was kind of a maritime association with one of the places in Weird Washington, kind of a little sightseeing icon in the Tacoma area. I wrote and emailed and tried making phone calls to the venue manager. Finally, I didn't get any responses. And finally, after consulting with Mark Moran about it, who really wanted that particular story, Mark said, go ahead and write it up. Even if he won't participate in it. He can't stop you from writing about it. It's a public venue. And I had eyewitness accounts. The place was haunted. So I did interviews with the people who experienced things. And Weird Washington came out, and it came out in time for Christmas. And New Year's Eve at like 12:35 in the morning, so, you know, 35 minutes into the next year, I got an email from this guy saying, Jeff, I will now sue you. How dare you write this story without me saying you can write this thing up, and so on and so forth. And I don't know for sure, but the timing suggests that he was drinking maybe a little bit too much champagne and his things kind of got out of hand, but
you never know.
we patched it up. Sometime later, I got an email from him saying, you know, you guys wrote the story without my permission, but how about we set up some venues and you guys can come over and front the book, and we'll we'll sell it together, do a book signing. I guess the threat was not all that serious.
I remember ticking off a guy associated with Maltby Cemetery, which was this little private family cemetery. Right now, in modern times, I mean, I guess it dates back to the 1920s or earlier, but today it's actually at the end of a backyard of a suburban home at the end of a cul-de-sac. I was able to track down a descendant of that family that's buried there. And just to try to get information, because there's certain stories that I felt would be conspicuous by their absence if we didn't include them, because mm-hmm. there's all kinds of
legends.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff about it on the internet, and people have all kinds of takes on it. It'd be kind of irresponsible to not bring that up in our cemetery chapter specifically. So I somehow tracked down this descendant, and he was kind of livid that I would even consider writing about it. And he's like, I don't give you permission to go there to take pictures or anything. I said, okay, that's fine. But, you know, essentially, read between the lines, you can't stop me from writing about it.
Yeah.
And so what I did for pictures, I actually tracked someone else down, again, on the internet off some message board, who had actually sometime before gone in and taken pictures. And I said, hey, can we, I think I might have passed this information along to Mark Moran, or, you know, CC'd Mark Moran in the email saying, hey, you know, can we use your pictures so that we technically don't have to go in and trespass? And he's like, oh, absolutely. Take what you need.
You know, Al, that so reminds me of what happened to you and I at a book signing a couple of years after Weird Washington came out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, my background is in archaeology, history, and historic preservation. And so I took these stories as a great opportunity to try and dispel some of these myths and to limit vandalism on these cemeteries. So the stories I wrote about the cemeteries usually had a couple lines about, please don't vandalize it. Please don't go at night. Please don't chip off the headstones for souvenirs.
Right.
And
don't be a douche.
Yeah. And and out in the Tri-Cities, in South Central Washington State, there was one of these other cemeteries that was pretty famous and local legend. It was one of these country cemeteries, these pioneer cemeteries, where probably in the past there were four land claims that all came together. And at the corner, all the families chose that little spot of ground for a small community cemetery. As happens in the pioneers' days, a lot of kids were buried there. That was called the Baby Grave Cemetery. And so I wrote about the vandalism there. And when we did that book signing in Tri-Cities, and this was 4 or 5 years after the book came out, the last person in line had this big old smile on her face as she looked down at me and said, "I wanted to tell you, you've ruined my life."
Yeah, that's right, because we went out there the day before with a local paper who they wrote an article about us, and they took photos of us standing out in that cemetery.
Yes.
And so she'd seen it that morning, and, you know, again, another livid person.
Yeah, and this is where people misperceive what goes on in some of these books, and or things you never thought would happen. Even in that newspaper article, I talked about, let's not vandalize these cemeteries, because from the time we visited to originally for the book, somebody had moved one of the gravestones, I think. But the cemetery was in really bad condition. The little white picket fence was all dirty, and there was no trespassing sign. It really did look abandoned. And I just felt bad for the cemetery itself.
Yeah, that's right.
The editing process, too. This also reminds me, we had 10 stories per chapter, but they didn't print all 10. They ended up cutting out some stories initially. We went through 4 or 5 different editing cuts before the final product. I remember they actually pulled a couple stories after they said, this is the final one. And when the book came out, they were minus a couple stories.
Yeah, that's right.
One of those instances was a story I wrote about the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Even though it's a nuclear reservation, there are 1 or 2 highways that actually go right through Hanford itself. And at the time, I was still in the service, and I had a top secret security clearance, and I really felt the need to protect that. So I talked to Mark Moran and said, "Hey, Mark, I'm not really comfortable about just driving through without telling anybody and taking pictures." And he kind of went on a rant about our authors are not afraid of the federal government. Actually, I was. And I told him. So when I went in, I stopped at the first guard kiosk I could find, alerted them to my identity, and gave them my federal army ID number as well as my driver's license, and said, "I'm just gonna stay on the public roads, but I will stop and take photographs. Please don't arrest me." And for a little while, as I was taking photographs, they did kind of shadow me, but nobody stopped me. I took my pictures, finished writing the article, sent it all in to Mark, and in the next to final draft of the book, there was pictures and an article about Hanford. However, when it came out in the final book, the article was gone. But if you have a copy of Weird Washington, in one of the chapter headers, they left the overall illustration, this kind of mosaic, and it still includes Hanford Nuclear Reservation. So that's one of the weird out of the books.
I was going to ask you, did you have any issues with cemeteries in Oregon at all? Because you did that chapter yourself, right?
Yeah, I did the Oregon chapter and didn't have any issues at the time of publication. There were 1 or 2 cemeteries that I went to Mark Moran and said, "Listen, this is the same kind of cemetery as one of these dilapidated community cemeteries. Please do me a favor and we'll just pull this one from the story." And he was decent about it. He agreed. This was the hard part about sometimes dealing with a boss who spent most of his life in New Jersey, where everything is really, really close together.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Washington State and Oregon and Idaho, big distances from things. And all too often, they don't seem to have a frame of reference about this cemetery. There's nothing but dirt roads for 5 miles.
Yeah, New Jersey's definitely a much smaller area in which to categorize these kinds of stories.
Yeah. And I remember when it came time to start the book tour planning for Weird Washington, I got a phone call. I'm not sure if you did. I got a phone call from the public relations firm asking me to do a book signing tour. And I love doing those. I really do. and they wanted me to go from Vancouver, Washington to Tri-Cities to Spokane, and then... And then from Spokane, which is on the Idaho-Washington border, they wanted me to drive all the way over to Linwood for a book signing the next day. So,
that wouldn't happen.
and I said to them,
that's at least 7 hours or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I said to them, you know, you guys, are you going to arrange my hotel or what? Or do you want me to just send you a voucher? And they said, what? And I said, you know, that loop you're talking about, I've done it before for my own book signings. That's 1,000 miles. What? Yes, 1,000 miles. And so I could do Tri-Cities and Spokane in one day, but that's only if I do Tri-Cities, Barnes & Noble for lunch, and then I do a 9 o'clock Barnes & Noble in Spokane.
Right.
And they didn't believe me. And I said, where are you guys from? And they said, we're in Boston, Massachusetts.
Now, Google Maps was around by then, right? I mean, they could have, it wasn't as elaborate as it is today, but they could still measure distances.
Yeah. Well, I waited for them. I said, go ahead and measure the distance, get a map and a ruler and just draw straight lines or do it however you want to. And they came back about 10 minutes later. As I was waiting on the phone. Yeah, you're right. It's about 1,000 miles. And I said, yeah. So, and this was in 2007. And I think we were all really amazed in that time period. Gas was up to almost $4 a gallon. So I was really hot on them. I said, okay, so we now agreed it's 1,000 miles and it's going to take more than one day. You guys are going to pay for my hotel and my gas, right? Long pause. Well, Mr. Davis, I was Jeff before. Well, Mr. Davis, most of our authors are more than happy to go on these book signing tours without asking for any compensation.
Something for nothing.
And yeah, so I said,
well, and I question how true that is.
Yeah. Well, I
because they actually got some pretty established people to write those books.
Yeah, and but in my case, apparently I wasn't established enough for them to pay for the gas and you know, this is not Mark Moran and Mark Skirman. This is a business decision on their part. And so I say all this to our audience, between you and I and our audience, these were not evil people or anything like that. They just didn't have a concept of how much it would put me out. And to them, my services were not worth gas, food, and hotel room fees. But it was just one of these little funny things that if you write a book, which was a bestseller in Washington State for months and months, and people still buy it today. As a matter of fact, didn't you forward me a link? Somebody's quoting Weird Washington right now.
Recently, yeah. They said that it was a travel guide or travel guide style article. And at the end, they just had a list of sources, and Weird Washington, Weird Oregon were two of them.
Yeah. And I do book sales of my own published books, and you and I also have an author's deal with the Sterling Publishing that we get the books more or less at cost, and so I usually have a couple of the weird books, and they sell pretty quick, even now, 10 years later. It was so funny, that silence on the end. Most of our other authors are more than happy to pay for their book tours on their own.
Speaking of which, we were at Costco last night, and they had a fresh shipment in of Weird Washington.
How much were they selling for?
That I didn't. Donna saw it. My wife, Donna. I didn't get to look at the price.
Yeah, and that was the bad thing for Weird Oregon, was we had such good sales in Weird Washington 2006, 2007. I don't remember exactly when. And it was about 18 months later that Weird Oregon was scheduled to come out. But in that time, we had the crash of 2008 happen, and people were short on money. And I think there were other publishing difficulties too. As far as I know, they released the book first to Costco, where it sold for $10 a copy, not the list price of $20.
Yeah. Yeah. They, the way the Weird books worked is, since they were published by a Barnes & Noble subsidiary, Barnes & Noble stores would get the books for, like, say, 6 months. And then they would start allowing other places to carry them.
Yeah. And so it was, that was just so unfortunate, the economy and this and that, because I think both of us in Weird Oregon still turned in a great product.
The reason I asked you about Oregon cemeteries earlier was I was led to remember a really horrible review of Weird Oregon that somebody wrote on Amazon, where they were complaining about that we made fun of one of their friends' relatives' graves or something to that effect. It was actually in an entry that we had nothing to do with. I don't know who compiled that, but that just kind of appeared in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a gravestone of a teenager, and he apparently liked basketball a lot. And so his gravestone had a basketball on it. A stone or concrete basketball is kind of a memoriam, which I thought was so cute. But you're absolutely right. I didn't go take a picture of that. I didn't research the article on it. It was kind of a stock photo that the Marks either bought or somebody maybe even sent them.
Right.
Yeah. And we got the hate email on that one.
Yeah, somebody was highly offended. I was like, what? And they were slamming the whole book out of like one picture on one page.
Yeah, and
this innocuous thing.
Oh, we both had some weird witnesses for Weird Oregon, or weird events beyond the event. Remember the Enchanted Forest? That was one of your stories.
Yeah, the Enchanted Forest. I showed up, I'm just driving the I-5 corridor south in Oregon, compiling, data for my stories, for a bunch of them. And I stopped in at the Enchanted Forest, which is this little mom-and-pop theme park, very, very independent, very family, owned by a family, run by a family for over 20 years. You know, it's kind of a dying, the sad thing is it's kind of a dying breed, because the whole theme park industry's, over the years was taken over by Six Flags and Disney.
Mm-hmm.
And so these little privately owned parks kind of fall by the wayside and start getting dilapidated and all that kind of stuff. And there's several examples of that around the country. But this one in Oregon still seems to be going strong. And so I stopped in and, explained who I was. I'm Al, and I'm writing a book. And, here's I wrote this other book, Weird Washington. Now we're doing Oregon. The lady, the owner, was kind of eyeing me very suspiciously, and she's like, well, who do you have, any kind of business card? Or I'm like, well, I'm doing it freelance, but we don't have like business cards from the actual publisher. She's like, I don't know. I said, well, wait here for just a minute, if you will. I have copies of our other book in my car. I'll go get one. I'll bring it back. I'll show you exactly what I'm talking about. So I went and got the book, and I brought it back, and I showed her the author's page with our picture on it, and said, hey, here I am with my co-author Jeff. And finally she said, oh, okay, you're legitimate. And she told me that the reason she was so aloof about it was that some time before, some people had come up to her with a similar story, and they were requesting After Hours, and they ended up filming a porno movie in there right under their noses.
probably and, internal and external kind of stuff.
Yeah.
What I really meant for you in the audience, I meant external shots and establishing shots, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. But I mean, that was, I don't remember if I wrote about that, but that was a pretty weird and funny story in itself. Unfortunate, since they didn't want it to happen, but in the grand scheme of things, it adds to the lore and the mystique of that place.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how doing these books and traveling and meeting people spontaneously, especially people who wanted to be in the book, but somehow they really didn't want to, or they started putting conditions on us. I remember there was a hotel that was haunted that I'd written about in one of my own books, and I expanded the story. The hotel owner contacted me and said, I want to see the article you wrote on the hotel before you published. And I said, sure, why not? And, just to be a nice guy. And she came back and said, I don't like the wording on this one and that one. So I went ahead and kind of recommended some changes. And and I want you to add this, this, and that onto it too. And it was more touristy information than anything else. So when it came time to cut out some certain stories to make room in the book for the photographs, this is the only time I ever did this. In this case, was I recommended to Mark. I said, if you're going to take out any story, take that one out, because
I would have just made the lines she wanted you to write. I, would have highlighted them in red and say, hey, you have the option on taking these out. I wouldn't mind at all.
Yeah, no, I was just happier with the whole story itself. And yeah. A couple minutes ago, you had mentioned this one place also east side of the Cascades that the guy was kind of famous in those days because he got into a lawn chair with a whole bunch of balloons and went aloft. And he had a parachute just in case things went wrong, as well as a little pellet gun to shoot the balloons one at a time if need be.
Yeah, water bags for ballast.
Yeah, and he had bailed out of the chair, and they found his camcorder months later. And he was a local businessman, and I think, wasn't this one of these things that he did as a publicity stunt when he was expanding his gas station or something like that? I'm not sure of the detail.
He actually got wind of somebody else having done that before he did, and he thought, hey, that sounds like a hell of an adventure. I want to try that. And so, yeah, he would use it as a kind of a publicity opportunity for his gas station.
Yeah, which
and it kind of became an annual thing for him around every 4th of July.
Yeah, which was kind of a cool thing. I admit that. And so that's why we wanted him in the book. But that was one of your stories, but I was on the road, so I stopped to try and get some photographs, stock photos, photos of him or anything. And I remember I went in, and I think I had emailed, or you had emailed ahead, saying, hey, you know, book authors coming through. But I got there, I was directed to his business manager. And I don't just mean gas station manager, I mean like his publicity manager person.
Right.
And I got kind of a, well, you know, he's way too busy to talk to you. And
but he knew you were coming.
Yeah, knew I was coming, and knew why I was coming, to just try and get a download on some photos or current photos. And he said, no, he's too busy for that. And I said, okay, well, what about photos? And I had to prove to them, just like you did at Enchanted Forest, that I was writing a bona fide book. And they said, well, just go to our website and just download photos off the website, and then send us an email telling us which ones, and then we'll grant you approval or we won't. You know, it's times like that.
What a rigmarole.
Well, it's times like that that you're reminded we're just cogs in the wheel, and we're not all that yeah. important. And that's, in a way, it's a good thing. Just when I think that I'm the cat's pajamas or whatever other expression, something knocks me down and reminds me, nope, you're just an ordinary human being, Jeff.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in both books, Weird Washington and Weird Oregon, we had stories taken out. And I wanted to talk about one of the stories that I really like that was taken out. I don't know. Do you have one or two?
I believe, speaking of things that are absent, or that things that are conspicuous by their absence, I believe they took the Uncle Sam sign story out of the book, didn't they?
That long ago that I don't remember, but
I would have to look it up. But I think at some point it was at least, if it's not in there, or if it is in there, at some point there was talk about taking it out anyway. And I, you know, I was very vehement in telling them not to, because it's just, you know, it'd be kind of like a big fail, essentially, if it was, because everybody kind of knows about it. But I mean, I think because everyone knows about it, I think that was one of their considerations in taking it out. Oh, no need to cover it then. The Uncle Sam sign is one of those billboards where you have, you know, you can slide in those plastic letters. And it is down in Chehalis along I-5. And the owners of the property, it started with, I believe, the current guy's grandfather.
Alexander Hamilton of Hamilton Farm.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, a gentleman by the name of Alexander Hamilton Farm. And he would rent out billboard space. And then, you know, the 60s came around, and Lyndon Johnson and his wife Lady Bird went on this whole crusade about beautifying America by taking down billboards, which she felt were too, you know, numerous in places. And so he actually had more billboards, and he was forced to take all of them down except for that one. I don't know if that caused him to become a very hardcore conservative or if he already was, but he just started writing all kinds of, you know, anti-LBJ or just in general right-wing screeds on that sign, and he would change them once a week or so. And his son and grandson, I believe his grandson, pretty much continue that tradition to this very day. It seems like they're changed a lot less often, but they're pretty consistently timely. Yes. You know, up to the date news-wise.
Yeah, especially around April 15th, federal income tax time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember calling that guy and interviewing him, and man, he took my ear off with just, you know, just all kinds of conspiracy theories of, you know, oh, what was it at the time? I think it was the Trans-Pacific Partnership was starting to get suggested, and he was kind of fuming about that and, you know, ranted about that for 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah. And it's interesting that where the sign is, at a certain point, one of the Hamiltons, kind of underneath the sign, when there all of a sudden there was a freeway exit put in at that point,
okay,
they ended up putting in a trout farm or something like that underneath the sign right at the freeway exit. And apparently it didn't do that well. And so another year or two went by, and they leased the land with the whole parking lot to, I think it was a car dealership or something like that, some kind of service provider.
I think there's an RV dealership there now.
Yeah, yeah. And so you had asked me to go and get some photos of it, and I drove out, and they were expecting me. So there I showed up, and the guys were talking to me, and somebody called while I was there and started yelling about them because they didn't like the message on the board. And I listened to the poor guys try and tell these the phone caller, hey, is this, we just rent the land. It's not us putting this up. And then they got out their little cassette player answering machine, and they played me some messages. And it's interesting when people get an answering machine, how much ruder they will be rather than talking to a live person, unless you happen to be calling a credit card company or something.
Yeah. I mean, you know how it is between us. We discuss politics sometimes, and, you know, oftentimes we disagree, as would I for the majority of the time with the Hamiltons and their sign. But I completely have to admire, you know, their choice of medium, essentially. They kind of, you know, they create a local landmark and express their opinions at the same time. That's kind of a special thing to me. It's kind of, you know, becomes a landmark. You can use it to give people directions or whatever. Yeah. It's entertaining.
Is either north or south of the Alexander Hamilton sign, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's it was all interesting putting the books together, and I appreciated the opportunity. Probably one of the things that was more interesting, that one of the stories that they took out of mine that made it almost to the last cut, there were two separate stories. One was on firewalking, because for many years in the Guinness Book of Records, the world's hottest firewalk took place in Washington State. And so they ended up saying, the mark said, okay, do an article on it. And we got paid after we'd emailed in the stories, and then emailed or sent a disc with all the photos. And it was at the end of that chapter, and I didn't have photos of a firewalk. Apparently they formatted this as we sent in the photos in the articles. So Mark sent me a couple emails saying, Jeff, where are my firewalk photos? Where are my firewalk photos? So I went ahead and put one on at my own house. So I got some scrap wood. I made sure there weren't any nails in it, and cleared a spot of land, and did it and sent in the photos. I still remember, and people ask me, and I talk about that firewalk. You're never quite the same afterward. You gain a lot of confidence. And depending on who you talk to, it's all physics, and you're not going to get burned because of the Leidenfrost and other elements of... It really doesn't matter either way. When you're standing looking at a bed of about 10 feet length of red hot coals with a little bit of fire going on the edges, you still hesitate, and you still have to physically and mentally focus yourself. And that's what I did. And I remember distinctly taking the first step across. And unfortunately for me, I had built my fire and spread the coals out over some kind of a rodent burrow, so that when I stepped down on the hot coals, my foot sank a couple of inches down, so that the coals were actually very high up on my ankle. And I did hesitate. I think subjective time, it was a couple of minutes, but in reality, it must have been only a fraction of a second where I thought, you know what, that kind of hurts. and I don't like it, but the only way out is really straight ahead. If I scream and jump up, that's going to push my foot even deeper into the coals. And I've still got to get this done, otherwise I'm not going to get paid. So I just kept on going. And my neighbor who was watching said he saw me hesitate a fraction of a second, and then I just kept on going. And in this case, I think I got a nickel or dime-sized blister on the bottom of my foot, but that was it. And Mark had sent you an email about that. What did he say?
Yeah, when I was back out in New Jersey and I was visiting the Marks, and Mark Moran was going through directories of just material for the book, and he said, "Hey, Al, were you around when Jeff did this? Do you firewalking?" And he's like, look how he took one for the team. And I was like, I don't think I was aware of that at the time.
Yeah, that was interesting. And kind of the fallout from that was also interesting. This is when the TV show was on, and there was a lot of hype about the Weird US itself. And he sent me a separate email that said, "Jeff, we may have a deal with not a used car dealership, but a rental car place, and we want some video footage from around the country of weird things. If we sent you a video camera, a movie camera, would you video one of your firewalks, and then you get to keep the camera?" These days, of course, every cell phone has a camera on it, but you remember those were a couple $100 back then.
Oh, yeah.
And so because I have no pride, and I love money, and I love toys, I went ahead and put on a couple more firewalks and sent the video off to Mark, and then...
And I was there for one of them.
Yeah, yeah, and then the deal fell through, and we never got to be seen doing firewalking.
They did put out a few of those videos. I believe it was for Hertz. Uh-huh. Hertz Rent-A-Car. But they did put out a couple of those videos, and one of mine made it in because I went to Seattle and I just filmed a few little things I'd written about in the book. But I think they ended up posting a lot fewer than they expected to.
Yeah, yeah. It was, yeah, overall it was an interesting experience. Working on these books was a great experience. Too bad that we didn't get the offer to do an update.
Yeah, that's like our number one demand.
Yeah.
Whenever we do a signing or just meet people, is there going to be a sequel? When are you going to make a part two? And the answer is we're not, unless, you know, it's kind of an unofficial sequel that we self-publish or something like that.
Yeah, or people
but we can't call it Weird Washington Volume 2. We'd have to come up with something else.
Yeah, or we can have all of our fans send emails to Mark Moran and Mark Skirman demanding another book.
We can. I don't know how good, you know... I don't know how well that would work.
Well, that's just...
But by all means.
That's just a thought. And I think it's a quite simple web address, weirdus.com, isn't it?
Editor at weirdus.com, yes.
There we go. So please, if you're going to help us out, people, so do that. But don't be mean.
Weirdus, all one word. Like weirdus. no periods after U and S.
That's cool.
Because that'll just confuse the internet and blow it up.
Yeah.
You know, everyone will be mad at you.
Yeah. Hey, we are almost at the end of our time. We had a whole list of other things we might have talked about, but for everybody else, you do a lot of different computer-aided graphics for games and things like that. Why don't you very quickly talk about that?
I've worked in the game industry for amount of years. I can't specify the exact amount because there's a high amount of ageism in my industry. So let's just say for long enough to be pretty experienced. I started off at a company called Sierra Online, which many, I hate to say it, but older fans of computer games would be familiar with. But I worked there for 4 years, and from there I kind of hopped around to various companies in the Puget Sound, working anywhere from a few months to 4 more years at certain places. And yeah, it's been a fun ride. I'm currently doing pretty much the same thing, except I'm telecommuting to a small startup in Oakhurst, California, where incidentally I lived for a year. So these are old, I wouldn't say they're old colleagues because I didn't really know them back then, but because of our industry and because of where they're located, we had, you know, common friends and we knew of each other. And they were working on a project that I was kind of a good fit for, and we contacted one another, and we've made it work for 2 years so far, if not a little longer.
Uh-huh. Well, and that's great.
That's about it.
Always good to be earning some money and actually finding work. Sometimes,
oh, yeah.
Sometimes the work is more important than the money.
That's right. I'm part of, I guess, what they call now the gig economy, where, you know, everything is unfortunately hop from job to job rather than gain, you know, long-term permanent employment. But we can blame Microsoft for some of that, by the way. They're the ones who kind of popularized people working contracts.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Periodically, I do see a rant on your Facebook feed about Microsoft.
Yeah.
All right. Any websites you want to share?
You can go to euphrasio.com if you want to see some of my handiwork on that end, on the computer game end. Artwork. There's, of course, weirdus.com and weirdnj.com for all your weird needs. If you don't mind my plugging another podcast.
No, not at all.
There's two of them then. My favorite podcast, except of course for this one now, is Last Podcast on the Left at lastpodcastontheleft.com. It's not political. They actually cover pretty much morbid topics or things like we covered in the books, except they've been doing it a lot longer. Well, they've been doing it for a while, and they do it with a healthy amount of comedy, and it's pretty entertaining. There's another similar, kind of similar podcast called That's Weird, which are two women from the Seattle area who actually have admitted to, you know, referencing a lot of their stuff from our books. And so I contacted them just basically as a, you know, hey, good job. You know, you told this story well and in an entertaining way. And so we kind of developed this email rapport back and forth. And they recently did a story on something in New Jersey, and I wrote them an email saying, oh, yeah, well, you wrote about this area. Did you know about all this other stuff in the area? And it seems like they're kind of overwhelmed by it, because they're like, oh, you gave us like a dozen more things to talk about now. But their website is thatsweird.org.
Okay. Well, that's pretty nifty.
And, yeah. A little bit of a language alert on both of them. but they are pretty entertaining.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I suppose that I should let you go now. And it's always a pleasure talking to you, Al. And it's too bad we live too far away to have every Friday night dinner together.
Right, right. Yeah, we'll get together soon.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And let's all stay weird.
Yes, sir.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And to everyone else out there, I want to thank you for tuning in and listening to this discussion on what it was like for Al and myself to write Weird Washington, Weird Oregon. And I hope that you managed to find copies of one of the weird books for your states. I think they make really good trip planners, especially for those of you interested in the odd and unusual. So thank you very much, and we'll meet again soon. Theme music has been Danse Macabre by Camille Saint-Saëns, performed by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Thank you for listening to The Peculiar World here on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.